Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Who wrote the stirring words delivered by John F. Kennedy at his inauguration 50 years ago? Historians rank Kennedy's 1961 inaugural address among the greatest speeches ever given by an American president, and it's hard for anyone to be uninspired by JFK's plea to ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. But historians have long argued over the primary authorship of the speech, pointing to the apparent involvement of several other people, notably advisor and speechwriter Theodore Sorensen. Writer Thurston Clark, however, has uncovered what he believes is incontrovertible evidence that the ideas in the speech and most of its most stirring and memorable passages originated with the president himself. Thurston Clark's book, which has just been updated and re-released in trade paperback, is called Ask Not, The Inauguration of John F. Kennedy and the Speech That Changed America. Thurston, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having me.
We should start this by saying that Kennedy was unquestionably a president who understood and believed in the power of words. Can you talk about that?
Yes. Not only believed and understood, but was determined that his speeches, particularly this one, would be remembered as an example of great oratory. I mean, he set out to write and deliver a great inaugural address when he, during the campaign, for example, before he knew he was going to be elected, he was collecting ideas on scraps of paper and quotations that he might use in the speech. From time to time, he'd stop, have his motorcade stop next to roadside historical markers, and he'd note them. And one of his aides said to him, "Well, what are you doing?" And he said, "Well, I think I might use that for my inaugural address." So this was something he was leading up to, and in fact, some of the ideas and the words in the speech, and particularly Ask Not, you can see developing throughout the campaign. When he finally gave Ted Sorensen the assignment of writing a first draft, he told him to study the Gettysburg Address and to learn its, quote, secrets.
And Kennedy looked at things in an almost scientific way in terms of word count, and he wanted to compare himself with other inaugural addresses that other presidents had given?
Yeah, Kennedy was, as we know, a very competitive person. He'd been raised in a very competitive household. The idea was to win whatever contest you entered into, and delivering an inaugural address is somewhat of a contest. It's the only speech that every single American president has given. And Kennedy knew that his speech would be compared to Eisenhower's and FDR's and Lincoln's. So he was, you know, determined that it would that he would come off well when what he called the High Court of History judged the speech.
And for reasons that the nation didn't know at the time, he thought he might not get a second shot, not because he expected to be assassinated, but because he knew that his health was much worse than he'd let on.
Yeah, that was a continuing concern throughout the 50s. Particularly, he had a back operation in 1955 that turned out very badly. It didn't help his back, and it almost killed him. And he was, in fact, given the last rites. On another occasion, he'd been given the last rites. So he had that concern. But he also, you know, he'd won by such a small margin in the popular vote, 125,000 votes, which was the narrowest margin in almost 100 years. And so he wasn't sure he was going to be reelected either.
What was going on in the world at the time that he was about to make this speech that he felt like he needed to address?
Well, there were a couple of things, but if we want to talk about the most immediate thing that he had to address, Nikita Khrushchev had given a very tough and very controversial speech about 2 weeks earlier in Moscow that essentially called on the communist parties everywhere to support anti-colonial wars, wars of national liberation around the world, and essentially to basically take them over and turn, as had happened with Fidel Castro in Cuba. And Kennedy gave a copy of Khrushchev's speech to all the people, the major players on his incoming administration, and said, you know, read, and I want you to read and digest this. But also, his speech There's a line at the beginning of his speech, which was kind of his answer to Khrushchev, which is the famous, "We shall pay any price, bear any burden, meet any hardship, support any friend, oppose any foe."
Let me pause. Let me have you pause right there. We actually have a clip of that exact line. Let's listen to the president deliver those words himself.
Great.
Let every nation know, whether it wishes us well or ill, that we shall pay any price, bear any burden, meet any hardship, support any friend, oppose any foe, to assure the survival and the success of liberty.
Strong words.
Strong words, and actually strong words somewhat out of keeping with the rest of the speech. And the rest of the speech is rather conciliatory, and it's an invitation to the Soviets to cooperate in negotiations on limiting nuclear weapons and limiting testing. And it's also a cautionary, the rest of the speech has a lot of cautionary lines about what Kennedy calls the dark powers of destruction, the spread of the deadly atom. He says, let us never negotiate out of fear, but let us never fear to negotiate. And actually, as it turned out, he wasn't really willing to pay any price or bear any burden. He wouldn't follow the suggestion of his advisors to send 40,000 combat troops, units into Laos a few months later. He made the mistake of the Cuban Missile Crisis, Bay of Pigs, and vowed that he would never do that again. Cuban Missile Crisis, everybody wanted him to not the blockade. There was almost unanimity that we should take out with air attacks on the Cuban missile sites, and Kennedy resisted that. So there really wasn't that line, although very stirring and Churchillian, didn't really give us a preview of what Kennedy, of the rest of the speech, or what Kennedy was going to do. And in fact, the headlines in most of the newspapers after the Kennedy delivered the speech called it a peace speech, and they praised him for as opening up a new quest for peace with the Soviet Union. So it certainly wasn't the way the speech was seen at the time.
He talks also about the role of the United Nations. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, yeah, that he was. There's a particular line in which he talks about, and he talks about the United Nations. He says to that World Assembly of Sovereign States, the United Nations, our last best hope in an age when the instruments of war have outpaced the instruments of peace. We renew our pledge of support. Hard to imagine a president now calling the United Nations our last best hope, isn't it?
Yeah, certainly not in an inaugural address.
Yeah. But you asked me a minute ago about, you know, what was going on, and I think we've talked about that was what was going on the international front. But domestically, the country was very worried. 3 years before, there had been Sputnik. The feeling was that we'd fallen behind the Russians and that we'd gone soft. We didn't have any purpose. There was a lot of talk about what the national purpose should be. John Steinbeck wrote an essay that was, widely referred to in the popular press, in which he talked about a vacancy in the American soul.
There were also references to a sort of a rising generation and the fact that the world was changing. And I have to imagine that was not only on the international front, but it had something to do with the climate domestically.
Well, yes, there's the famous line that begins, the torch has been passed to a new generation.
He was this young president.
Exactly. He was referring to his generation, the people who had fought in World War II, who had served as enlisted men or as young officers, and they were the ones who were taking over from Eisenhower's generation, the people who had been the generals and the leaders of the war. But there was an even younger generation below that of teenagers and college students who hadn't fought in the war, who were at the time eager to hear this call to sacrifice that Kennedy gave them. In fact, there was a very interesting poll in Look magazine done about 6 months before Kennedy delivered the speech, in which the article was called, I think, "The Restless Generation, Explosive Generation," and it said it had a strong desire for goals and purposes. And as if to prove it, they polled a whole bunch of college students, and they offered them a kind of menu of 15 wonderful things, and they had to decide which they wanted the most. Well, only 2% of them picked a new car, and 64% shows a PhD, not just a BA, but a PhD.
It does seem that Kennedy understood what was coming in the decade even that would follow after his death.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Not just what was coming kind of politically, but also culturally.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people talk about Kennedy being the first television president because of his success in the first debate with Nixon. But he was both. He was kind of one of the last great literate presidents, really, in the sense that he was someone who read widely, who had written a Pulitzer Prize-winning book and had produced a number of articles, some of them he'd produced and some Ted Sorensen. But that it was a time when just in the 1960 kind of television was taking over from Life and Look, the big picture magazines, as a principal way that that Americans got visual images and also received their news. And he was kind of comfortable in both mediums. So it was a very fortuitous time for him to be delivering this inaugural address, too. Which, of course, the words were wonderful, but also the images were so good.
And Kennedy, of course, is famous even throughout the campaign for understanding the power of images. And there's a great sort of section of the book where the entire Kennedy clan heads down to Palm Beach, Florida. And in addition to working on the speech and planning for the inauguration, they're all working on their suntans.
Well, I know. That was this was when there was that phrase, healthy tan.
Right.
Which is now an oxymoron, but everybody believed that because a tan made you look healthy, that it therefore had to be healthy for you as well. And they were all the Kennedys were absolutely determined to be kind of tan all the time, not just JFK, but Bobby and Eunice and the whole bunch of them. And of course they could do it because they had Hyannis for half of the year, and then they had Palm Beach in the winter. So they were constant tanning opportunities for the Kennedys.
I have to tell you, the idea of Joe Kennedy constructing a special shelter to sunbathe naked is one that I could have done without.
I know.
Did Joe have any influence at all on what was in the speech? Would Kennedy have shown him?
He wanted to, but by that point, Kennedy, although he loved his father, still knew better than to show him the speech ahead of time.
Mm-hmm. So
and he hinted, he was saying, "I hope you have a good speech," but JFK wouldn't let him see it.
And the flight down from Washington to Palm Beach was a great time for Kennedy to sort of buckle down and work on it.
Yeah, that's a really crucial moment in the development of the speech, because at that point, Kennedy has got essentially Sorensen's final draft. And he'd seen a draft from Sorensen a few weeks earlier, and he hadn't been that happy with it. And he'd sent out the telegram just before Christmas to Stevenson and Galbraith and Rusk and to all these people asking for suggestions, not giving them the draft, but asking for suggestions for lines. And that's how we come up with "Let us never negotiate out of fear, but let us fear to negotiate," because that was one of the lines that he came up with, that I think Galbraith came up with. So what we have then on the 10th of January, as he's heading down to Palm Beach, he calls his secretary, Evelyn Lincoln, into his private compartment to take dictation. Now, Kennedy composed his speeches. He didn't sit down with a yellow legal pad and write out a first draft in his hand. He dictated. And that's just what he did. He had a copy of the Sorensen draft. And he dictated changes and, more importantly, additions and things to it. And
let me have you pause right there, Thurston. Yeah. We're going to take a break. Thurston Clark is my guest. His book is called Ask Not, The Inauguration of John F. Kennedy and the Speech That Changed America. Join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education, announcing a 9-month intensive CFP certificate program starting in January in Plano. You can learn more at smu.edu/CFP.
You're are listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author Thurston Clark. His book has just been re-updated and reissued in trade paperback. It's called Ask Not, The Inauguration of John F. Kennedy and the Speech That Changed America. Join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Before the break, Thurston, you were describing to us Kennedy sitting down with his secretary, Evelyn Lincoln, and dictating to her additions to the speech that Sorensen had given him, major changes. I think what's really remarkable is that Evelyn Lincoln was with him for a long time, but never got over her astonishment at how Kennedy could sort of write in the air. He could speak as if he were writing a speech.
Yes, and in fact, he did it in the style of his hero, Daniel Webster. He had a collection of first editions of books written about Webster going back 100 years, and he admired him for his ability. In fact, he mentions him in Profiles in Courage and says that Webster was able to think out a speech sentence by sentence but never wrote things down. And that's what Kennedy did, not only through dictation, but through his extemporaneous remarks. He would often, during the campaign, take a Sorensen or a speech that had been provided by one of his other speechwriters to the podium and use some of it and then basically just fill up the rest of the time with his own extemporaneous remarks. And sometimes you can see this because there's copies of the speech is written and the speech is delivered. And you'll see that a week or two later, Sorensen will write another speech, and this speech will incorporate some of the remarks that Kennedy made extemporaneously earlier. So this makes it kind of hard sometimes when you look at a Sorensen speech to know if those words originated with Sorensen or some of them might have originated with Kennedy and kind of Sorensen had taken them over. And, of course, Kennedy did the same thing, that lines that Sorensen wrote for him in one speech, sometimes a month later, he would begin to speak extemporaneously, and he would be recalling from his memory lines from a Sorensen speech of a few weeks or a few months earlier.
To the end of his life, which in fact ended just a few months ago, Ted Sorensen maintained that the inauguration speech was mostly Kennedy's, that Profiles in Courage was Kennedy's book, but he did have a significant role in writing that Pulitzer Prize-winning book. Is that right?
Yeah, he did, and again, it's somewhat the same idea. The actual profiles of the senators, I think, was mostly Sorensen's research and work. But I've looked at the yellow legal, the stuff that Kennedy wrote. He actually didn't dictate his contributions to profiles. He was in flat on his back for months after this disastrous back operation. He was down in Palm Beach, and he was actually writing things. And you can see in his handwriting a lot of the points that really set the tone for the book in the introduction and the conclusion were original with Kennedy. And so, although, again, if you do a word count of Profiles in Courage and if you do a word count of the inaugural address, I suspect if you could figure it out, you'd find that Sorensen, word by word, contributed more. But in both cases, I think that the most notable passages, the most poetic and moving, came from Kennedy. Not all of them, but more likely they originated with Kennedy.
So you mentioned these yellow legal pads. Kennedy had famously bad handwriting, and I thought this was a funny detail that, in fact, after he died, the Kennedy Library couldn't interpret things, and they would
call in
Evelyn Lincoln to
translate. Well, they do, because also Kennedy was a fanatical doodler.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, one of the reasons that he wanted his speech to be so short was he was personally so bored by long speeches and people that went on and gas bags. He just hated them. And he would kind of drum his fingers on his teeth, and he had all these nervous tics. And one of his nervous tics was to doodle. And the doodles are all available in the Kennedy Library. Most of them have had to be translated by Evelyn Lincoln because there's no way of knowing what he was writing half of the time.
Did he draw pictures?
He drew pictures, too. They're very crude. There's a few stick men and things. He often drew boats,
mm-hmm.
kind of sailboats and things. But mostly, he'll write. I was just looking recently at a notes that he wrote during a meeting with Henry Cabot Lodge in 63 before he sent him to Vietnam as ambassador. And Lodge was just boring him. And you can listen because there's a tape of Kennedy taped the conversation. Lodge didn't know he was being taped. You can hear Kennedy going, trying to hurry him along. And then from that conversation, there's just this huge page of doodles in which he's just written Lodge again and again. Henry Cabot, Ambassador Lodge, Governor Lodge, Senator Lodge, you know, every kind of word you can put before Lodge.
We have an email here from Anne in Weatherford who says, this is fascinating background. I think Ted Sorensen's role in crafting much of the American University speech is pretty well documented.
Yes, it is.
How do you rate it in comparison to the inaugural address?
I think it's, word for word as literature, I think it's as good, if not better. I think that part of what makes the inaugural address so memorable are the images at the same time, the moment, the fact that we were having our first Catholic president, the youngest man ever elected to the presidency, seceding the oldest, the snowbanks, the presence of Robert Frost, all of that. The American University speech is elegant, certainly the best speech after the inaugural address of his presidency.
Remind us of the content, again, of the American University speech.
It was called the peace speech, and it was essentially Kennedy saying two things that no American president had said since the end of World War II, and one was that the Russians sacrificed and lost more people than the rest of us, and we couldn't have won the war without them, probably. And the second was these are human beings like us, and they have the same desires, and they're human, and they share the same planet, and we have to start treating them like fellow human beings. And then it was a call for, I think the line was, not just peace in our time, but peace for all time. And it was followed up immediately within weeks of the beginning of negotiations for a test ban treaty that led to the limited test ban treaty being signed a few months later, which was the first treaty concerning nuclear weapons ever between the United States and the Soviet Union.
Because of the things that remain on tape and that we can see even today, Kennedy comes across as a sort of natural speaker, but it turns out this was not the case.
No, he was not. He was a pretty his delivery was not very good, and it was something that concerned him and concerned the people around him. When he was a senator and when he was campaigning for the Senate and for the House of Representatives, he would rush his words. He'd speak in a flat monotone. He was a nervous speaker, too. People who were close to his podium who could see him noticed sometimes that his hands would shake and his leg would jiggle a little bit. Bobby Kennedy had the same problem, the same kind of nervousness. So what he did was he really worked on it. He got a speech coach. He had people with stopwatches time him to see how many words a minute he was speaking when he went on television. And so he worked it. He worked at this. You know, it was not something that came naturally to him at all.
Did he work on toning down the sort of Harvard overtones in his voice?
I don't know about that. You mean the accent?
Yeah.
I don't think so. Not too much. I think that that was part of it. Became identified with him, and kind of it was part of his charm. The question about whether he toned down the kind of Harvard aura around him
to be a man of the people.
Be a man of the people. Well, that's what you know. Frost wrote a poem that he couldn't deliver because the sun was so bright that Frost couldn't read the. Read the words, which was fine with Kennedy. He didn't want him. He wanted him to. In fact, he'd only invited Frost to come to the inauguration after much soul searching because he was afraid he was going to upstage him and deliver a wonderful original poem and people would remember Frost and not Kennedy. So again, that's another example of a kind of competitive spirit. So Frost was only allowed to come if he agreed to ahead of time that he was going to recite this poem, The Gift, outright, that Kennedy knew. And Kennedy even asked him to make one or two little changes in the text of the speech he'd already written. And Frost agreed to that. But, of course, Frost was a sly fox. And he, the night before, he stayed up all night writing what he called an introduction to the poem. And the introduction turned out to be another poem that was longer than The Gift outright. But he couldn't deliver it. In fact, it had a very evocative last two lines. It ended with Frost saying, "A golden age of poetry and power, of which this noonday is the beginning hour." And when Frost came to the White House a few days later, he gave him the poem, gave him a copy, And as he left the Oval Office, he turned to Kennedy and he said, "Be more Irish than Harvard." In other words, go for your emotions, you know, more than sometimes lead with your emotions rather than your head. And this has been a criticism lodged against Kennedy by a number of writers and others who knew him, that he was too passionless, that he didn't have enough moral passion. And, anyway.
Talk about the Irish thing, because, you know, in 2011 in this country, anti-Irish sentiment is pretty much unheard of. It's certainly not a major social force, but it was in 1961.
Well, and even more important, yes, and it had been even stronger when Kennedy was growing up. I mean, the geography of Kennedy's early life was determined by anti-Irish prejudice in the Boston area, by the Boston Brahmins, the WASPs, people like Henry Cabot Lodge. It's why his father, why they went to Hyannis. They tried to go to Cohasset, which was a tonier seaside town closer to Boston. But the Kennedys got blackballed from the club there, and so Joe Kennedy moved them to Hyannis, and then he took the whole family and piled them into a private railway car, and they moved to New York City. Because he didn't want his kids, he said, "I don't want them brought up in Boston, where there's so much prejudice about." And they still had this. I mean, even around the time around the time of the inauguration, Rose Kennedy, his mother, turns to one of his friends and says, "When do you think the nice people of Boston are going to accept us?"
And even on her tour of the White House with Mamie Eisenhower before the Kennedys moved in, there was a sort of a slight in that.
No, it was actually when they were driving. On the inauguration morning,
okay,
in the motorcade, Eisenhower was in one car with Kennedy, and then in another car, or sitting in the back seat, I can't remember which, was Mamie Eisenhower was sitting next to Jackie, and Mamie remarked to someone else in the car, "Doesn't Ike look like, in his top hat, doesn't he look like Paddy the Irishman?" A slur, and who knows if it was intended or not, probably not, but it was, Jackie heard it and mentioned it later to Arthur Schlesinger, and I'm sure she mentioned it to her husband as well.
So it was a very cold morning, but Kennedy quite literally had some tricks up his sleeve so that he could look hale and hearty while everyone else was shivering.
Well, he had long underwear on, but also... yeah, he was, this again was part of the stagecraft. He knew how it would look on television, that all the other guys would be bundled up in these huge, heavy overcoats. And he would look younger and stronger and braver standing out in the cold weather, just in a suit, you know, without an overcoat on. It was part of the whole thing. I mean, he met with executives from CBS a couple of days beforehand, and they talked about how to film a presidential speech or inauguration and make it more interesting, because before they just had one camera kind of face on with the president giving a speech, and the inaugural address was the first one where they played with different cameras at different angles. So they had also had reaction shots from the crowd as Kennedy was speaking, and they had him in profile. They took him from behind. I mean, it made for more interesting television.
No overcoat deliberately. He almost didn't have a collar to wear.
Well, he had gained quite a bit of weight. His main source of exercise in the winter and when he became president before was swimming. He liked to swim indoors. And he had gained weight. I guess a lot of politicians gain weight during a campaign, and he'd gained so much that he couldn't fasten his collar. And so they had to send people out looking for a stud that would, it was very much at the last minute. But it illustrated Kennedy was quite a vain man. He traveled with a scale and was constantly worried and talking about his weight and his appearance with people. He was very vain about his hair. He used to brush it, and he'd comb it all the time. But he had to be very careful not to comb it when there were any press photographers around, because he didn't want them to catch him combing his hair.
So it was supposed to look sort of carelessly perfect.
That's right. He used to comb his hair when he was in a motorcade, when he went under an underpass or through a tunnel, so he couldn't be seen.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Thurston Clark is my guest. Let's go to Jim in Dallas. Hello, Jim.
Oh, thanks. I have a question about the speech as it affected the question of detente that just loomed after his assassination. Do you think that that is where this whole feeling that this was his aim as a politician started?
Detente with the Soviet Union?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, yes, I think so, and it was because it was well underway in the last months before Dallas, really as a result of the near catastrophe and almost nuclear war during the Cuban Missile Crisis. It was very sobering, not just for Kennedy, but for Khrushchev as well, and they engaged in a frequent and secret correspondence between each other for months, and that's what led up to the American University speech and to the Test Ban Treaty. The Test Ban Treaty was signed in October, beginning of October 63, just 6 weeks before he was assassinated. And Kennedy was planning to visit Moscow early in 1964. The plans were already being made with the Russian ambassador, Dobrynin, to set up this. And Kennedy fully intended to go to Moscow. Also, in the fall, before he was assassinated, there was a very controversial Russian grain deal where we sold grain to the Soviet Union. A lot of the people in the Republican Party and the conservative Democrats didn't like that at all. And the first hotline was installed between Washington and Moscow in August of that year. Kennedy also proposed a joint exploration and joint scientific cooperation in outer space at the UN in September. So this was very much the wheels were turning already before Dallas.
Author Thurston Clark is my guest. His book is called Ask Not, The Inauguration of John F. Kennedy and the Speech That Changed America. Join our conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372 or let us know what's on your mind via email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education, announcing a 9-month intensive CFP certificate program starting in January in Plano. You can learn more at smu.edu/CFP.
In the long history of the world, only a few generations have been granted the role of defending freedom in its hour of maximum danger. I do not shrink from this responsibility. I welcome it. I do not believe that any of us would exchange places with any other people or any other generation. The energy, the faith, the devotion which we bring to this endeavor will light our country and all who serve it. And the glow from that fire can truly light the world. And so, my fellow American, ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
That, of course, a cut from John F. Kennedy's 1961 inaugural address. My guest this hour is Thurston Clark, whose new book is called Ask Not, The Inauguration of John F. Kennedy and the Speech That Changed America. Thurston, what do we know about the origins of that most famous line of this famous speech?
Well, Ask Not, as far as how Kennedy's concerned, there have been other, it's been identified as similar sentiments have been voiced by people like Oliver Wendell Holmes and Woodrow Wilson, and I mean, it's not a particularly original idea, but it's the way he framed it, and the fact that the man who was saying it in this case was himself someone who was a decorated war veteran who had sacrificed for his country. But the line kind of develops during the campaign, we were talking about how he said things extemporaneously. In Anchorage, Alaska, beginning of September, he has a version of this extemporaneously that he inserts into a speech. Then a couple of days later, at Labor Day, with the real kickoff for his campaign in Detroit, he says, "The new frontier is not what I promise I will do. It is what I ask you to join me in doing." Then 3 weeks later, in a nationally televised speech from Washington, D.C., he said, "We do not campaign stressing what our country is going to do for us as a people. We stress what we can do for the country, all of us." So you can see this kind of this idea developing and changing until finally it's in the reading copy of his speech on Inauguration Day, and he changes one word. He made 32 changes to the speech as he delivered it. That are not on the reading copy that he took to the podium, and he didn't mark up the reading copy because he thought it was a historical document. He didn't want to deface it.
How significant are the changes that he made?
Well, ask not what your country will do for you, ask what you can do for your country. I think it's stronger than having can in both of those clauses.
Yeah.
And he did that. He made another change where there was a line talking about a cold and bitter peace that had existed during the Cold War, of course. But he wanted to get away from, you know, the whole Cold War imagery and even get away from the word cold because it evoked the Cold War. So he exchanged hard. So he said hard and bitter peace instead of cold and bitter peace. And I believe he explained that change later to somebody.
Were people walking around talking about that line as soon as the speech was over?
I don't know about the line. They were talking about the speech as soon as it was over. There was a consensus right away that it had been a great speech. It wasn't like the Gettysburg Address that took quite a while to be appreciated. All of the editorial comments and the praise came from Republicans as well as Democrats that it had been what one person said of speech for the ages. Barry Goldwater said, "God, I would like to be able to do what that boy did," referring to him as a boy. But so yes, it was instantly recognized as a great speech, and of course, it's continued to be recognized as such. At the turn of the century, the 20th century, over 135 scholars of rhetoric and history got together to choose the best 100 best American speeches of the 20th century, and they ranked Kennedy's inaugural second beneath Martin Luther King's "I Have a Dream" speech. And in fact, the only inaugural address delivered after Kennedy's to make the list was Ronald Reagan's first, which came in at number 30. I mean, it's just been, and then the other thing is the editors of Time at the same time, at the end of the century, decided to choose the top 10 greatest American speeches of all time. And they put the Kennedy inaugural at number 7, one place above "I Have a Dream" and just 3 slots below the Gettysburg Address.
It's important to remember, as you mentioned, the election was quite a squeaker. He did not have an overwhelming majority. After the inaugural, in the weeks following, he enjoyed really good approval ratings.
Very good approval ratings. And in fact, one of the polls I think it was 6 weeks later to determine his approval rating and how he was doing, they asked a whole bunch of questions. And the last question was, who did you vote for, Kennedy or Nixon? And 62% of the people answering the poll, which was supposed to be a sample of the country, an accurate sample of the country, claimed to have voted for Kennedy, even though only 50% could have. So already, people were climbing on the bandwagon, and I think the inauguration and the speech was certainly one of the factors in determining that. He also had a very good transition, a very dramatic transition where he would announce the new members of his cabinet kind of one by one in front of his townhouse in Georgetown to the press. Again, it was great theater, televised on the evening news every night. He was very smart about television and about that.
So, Thurston, you have all kinds of really compelling evidence in this book that, in fact, Kennedy was the primary author of the speech. But we all understand in modern America that presidents have speechwriters and they have a lot of people who help them. Why does it matter if he wrote it?
It matters because this speech is his one of, well, first of all, it's one of his greatest accomplishments. I mean, it's generally acknowledged, as we just said, one of the greatest orations of 20th century American politicians. So it's important to know, you know, who, I think it's important to know who wrote it. And furthermore, the speech is also, as I point out in the book, a real distillation of Kennedy's own experiences, of his philosophy, his character, of his life, things he'd learned throughout his life. And if you deny him the credit for writing some of these passages that are really autobiographical, you kind of distance him and us and the rest of us from the truth of this speech, which was that it was not just written by him, but it expressed things that had happened to him in his life. I mean, the opening line, the beginning when he said, the torch has been passed to a new generation. Born in this century, that was him, tempered by war. He'd been tempered by war, disciplined by a hard peace. Again, Kennedy, proud of our ancient heritage. I mean, he was talking about himself and about his generation. Later in the speech, he talks about the graves of young Americans who answered the call to service around the globe. Well, those graves contained his brother, mm-hmm. Joe Kennedy, who had died in not a grave, but a marker, because his body was never found, in a very brave mission, flying from England to France to bomb the submarine pens in France. The graves also contained his brother-in-law, who was killed in the European theater, and the two crewmen from PT-109. So these are there's more in this, but there's. And I point out in the book how the speech, the various parts of it, express things that Kennedy had been, ideas that he'd been tussling with and expressing in speeches in the Senate, and you know, that things that he'd learned in his life over the last 20 or 30 years. So I think it's important to show that not only did it do this, and it did it because Kennedy had written most of it.
I thought it was a charming detail, by the way, that, you know, Kennedy went around collecting aphorisms and interesting lines from different places. And that was a habit that I gather he picked up from his mother.
His mother used to do the same thing. The Kennedys were great kind of memorizers of worthy passages. And they didn't just read a book when they read, well, they read a book, but they were always looking for things. And he had notebooks in which he wrote down bits of poetry and passages and things that he, you know, tried to memorize. His mother had done the same thing for her entire life, and she would sometimes pin these things to her sweater and would walk around to, kind of, until she'd kind of memorized them. So it was one. His mother didn't have as much influence on his life as his father, but this may have been one area in which she did.
You obviously listened to the inaugural speech of Barack Obama, which is the most recent one we've had. What did you think of it?
I didn't think. I was disappointed compared to his earlier speeches and his campaign speech. I think he consciously took his foot off the accelerator, the rhetorical accelerator, and I don't think he was intending it to be a great speech. Certainly. You know, he had been attacked again and again during the campaign for his eloquence, of all things. I mean, how are we ever going to have another great inaugural address if eloquence is being painted as a kind of vice rather than a virtue? But anyway, this was, you know, he was attacked as being a man of beautiful words, but that was it. Hillary Clinton several times repeated Mario Cuomo's quotation about, "You campaign in poetry, but you govern in prose." And then John McCain pledged to work hard to make sure, quote, "Americans aren't deceived by an eloquent but empty call for change." Joe Lieberman, who supported McCain's, declared that eloquence is no substitute for a record. Well, no wonder we don't get speeches like that anymore, if that's going to be the criticism of eloquence.
What about the first inaugural of George W. Bush?
You know, I can't remember it. Can you remember a line from it? I don't.
No, and honestly, I was thinking as I was reading this book, you always watch the inaugural addresses, but you don't often take a line away. Was it the 1,000 points of light speech from the first George Bush?
That was George H.W.
Right,
Bush.
Right, right. But
that was George H.W. I don't even know if it was 1,000 points of light in the inaugural or another speech.
I was going to ask you the same question. I don't know.
I don't know.
So I guess it's maybe once in a generation or so that there's a line that you really recall, or more than that.
Yeah, well, I mean, afterwards, after Barack Obama's inaugural, the takeaway line seemed to be, we've got to pick ourselves up and dust ourselves off. And that was, I mean, what was that? That's a line stolen from a Fred Astaire song. And he used it again. He again talked about dusting ourselves off in the State of the Union, his State of the Union speech. So a year later, I don't know. You know, I think it was an opportunity missed.
Can you talk a little bit, as we start to conclude here, about the relationship that Kennedy and Ted Sorensen had?
Yes, it was a funny relationship because it wasn't a social relationship at all. Sorensen was never invited upstairs for one of the kind of intimate dinner parties in the White House. Kennedy compartmentalized his friends, and he had, you know, there were people, Artie Schlesinger, he invited him upstairs because Jackie liked him, but Sorensen was not part of his social circle. He was a puritanical figure, and I don't think, Kennedy didn't think he'd be a lot of laughs up in the, you know, at dinner, and also he didn't like to bring his work from downstairs upstairs. But how, that being said, they had an incredibly intimate kind of intellectual life and understanding. Sorensen was sometimes referred to as Kennedy's intellectual blood bank, and people talked about them being intellectually incestuous. And it was true. I mean, there was probably no one who understood how Kennedy's mind worked, his political mind, and his intellectual mind, not necessarily his areas of his personal life, as Sorensen did.
I guess there could be no better description for someone who's going to be such a collaborator on the words that were to come from Kennedy's mouth.
Yeah, exactly. And, of course, the other thing is Sorensen had been with Kennedy since 1953. Sorensen was a young man. He was in his early 20s when he got the job. He had hardly done it. He hadn't traveled. I don't think he'd been to Europe before he started working for Kennedy. I don't know when Sorensen finally went to Europe.
It was also it was sort of obvious in the speech that Kennedy himself had traveled more than any other U.S. president, don't you think?
Probably the best traveled of our presidents, but also had in his travels happened to be in the right place at the right time. I mean, at a time when things were going to happen, because his father was ambassador to England. He was in Poland and Germany just within a week of when the Second World War began and was taking messages to his father in London. He was a kind of zealot-like figure.
Thurston Clark's book, which has just been updated and re-released in trade paperback, is called Ask Not, The Inauguration of John F. Kennedy and the Speech That Changed America. Thurston, thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.